This is Rachel Lynn, and you are listening to Upstage Left. It has been a minute since I've recorded an episode on here, and part of that is because I've been working over at Manhattan Theater Club, helping them with their podcast, and my latest episode for them is with playwright Rajiv Joseph, and I'm going to link that in the show notes because I love that episode, and I hope you check it out. But I am really so happy that you're tuning back in here. If you are a new listener, this is the perfect place to start, because in this episode, I speak with veteran TV, film, and stage actor Reed Burney. Reed made his Broadway debut in 1976, and he has been in the business ever since. He has been in so many world premieres, including Claire Barron's You Got Older, Man from Nebraska, Bug, I'm Gonna Pray for You So Hard, Annie Baker's Uncle Vanya, Circle Mirror Transformation, and he won a Tony Award in 2016 for his portrayal of Eric Blake in The Humans, and most recently he was in a play with his real-life son over at the Irish Rep in a play called Chester Bailey. I am so grateful for Reed for talking on the show, and he's incredibly honest about his career trajectory and the high highs and low lows, and I just find it really inspiring. So I'm so excited for you to hear this conversation. If you like the episode, please share it with a friend, shout us out on social media, or just say hello when you see me. I love that. Here is Reed Burney. All right. Hi, Reed.
Hi, Rachel.
How's everything going?
You know, so far, so good. Haven't cried yet today, so that's good.
That's good. Do you do one daily or is it like a weekly occurrence?
No, it's always, but there's always the fear that something will overwhelm. And
yeah, I'm so excited today to talk to you about your long and illustrious career.
Long. Sometimes I can't believe how long it's been.
You said you've known from an early age that you wanted to act. Is that right?
It's true. I'm one of those freakish kids. I don't think I'm that special, but I think I knew about five. I remember going to see, I believe it was the 1962 remake of Thief of Baghdad. I believe that was it. And watching it, transported, but also suddenly the penny dropped and I thought, oh, that's a job. That's something you can do. You can spend your life pretending. And it seemed incredibly appealing. So I've had my eye on the prize pretty much since then. There might have been a week where I wanted to be a fireman, but the rest of the time I wanted to be an actor.
And when you felt that feeling, did you tell your parents or did you keep it a secret?
I didn't keep it a secret. I have a memory of being surrounded by a group of adults, five or six adults, looking down at me and them saying, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I want to be an actor. And they all nervously turned to each other and laughed. Oh, dear. You know, it was a very peculiar thing to hear a five-year-old say.
Were your folks in the arts?
No, my mother had studied theater at Bennington, but I don't think she was particularly interested in acting. I think it was fun. And I think it was easy. I think it was probably an easy thing for her to do. But I don't think she was serious about it. My grandfather, rumor has it, wanted to be an actor. But, you know, times where he got back from World War I and you were a lawyer or a doctor or something. So no, I don't know where it came from. My mother and father loved the movies, loved going to the movies. And we often went as kids. But I don't know where it came from. You know, the older I get, the more I think it's just who we are. We're just sort of born with this thing that we have to do.
Mm.
Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I do feel that way, actually. I do. It's hard to get away from it.
It is hard to get away from it. And I think that's how you know if you're a lifer. I think a lot of people want to be actors because they want to be famous and they want to have, you know, looks like fun. But to have what it takes to really do it forever and go through the roller coaster ride, I think is, it's a very special kind of person.
Mm. Did you have siblings?
There are five of us. I'm the middle.
You're the middle.
Five. So that's probably a reason too. I probably crave some attention.
Did you ever get lost? Were you ever left behind?
I was lost once on the boardwalk at Ocean City. I got lost. I was probably about three, turned around and thought the person I was following was my father, and it wasn't. And the panic, I still can feel that panic. I was probably lost for about 35 seconds, but it felt like complete terror. But that's the only time I've literally been lost.
And so you have this like desire at age five to be an actor, to do community theater at that time. And where were you?
I did not. We were in a little town in Delaware called Seaford, Delaware. I did all the plays at school. My first community theater play was senior year of high school. I did a production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and I played Linus.
Oh my gosh. Wait, that was your senior year of high school, you said?
Senior year of high school, yeah.
I did. My first play, I played Lucy, that same play.
Oh my God, perfect for you. I mean, not saying you're crabby like her, but that I can really see you doing that. That's fantastic. Where'd you do it?
I did it at my high school. I was a sophomore, but yeah.
Fantastic. So yeah, I felt very, very grown up doing a play outside of school. I consider the start of my career, though, was in fifth grade, we did a production of Pinocchio, an operetta version of Pinocchio. And I played Pinocchio. And that was my first play at night. It was the school assembly, May 19th, 1965.
Ah, so do you sing?
I sing. I don't sing well enough to compete in the musical New York Broadway thing. But I've done musicals and I like doing musicals. But if I had to choose, which I think you kind of do, I'd rather do plays.
And so when you were a senior and you did these shows, had you already decided you were going to conservatory for college?
I was in the process of applying for college while I was doing, that was the fall of 71. And I applied to Carnegie Mellon and Juilliard and Boston University. Carnegie Mellon wasn't the slightest bit interested in me. At my interview at the end of the audition, they said, "Have you thought about going to Purchase? Since you live in New York." I was like, "No, I haven't thought about going to Purchase. What about Carnegie Mellon?" They couldn't have been less interested. And I got into Juilliard and I got into Boston University, and I turned down Juilliard because I thought 15 hours of acting a day would make me hate it. And I wanted some kind of college experience. You know, I wanted to have a campus and live in a dorm and do all that stuff. And New York City didn't seem like it was going to give me that. But after freshman year at BU, which I loved, I really didn't like sophomore year at all. And I wanted to suddenly see about going back to Juilliard. And they said, "I have to reapply." And I thought, oh, I don't know if lightning will strike twice. So I didn't. But I dropped out of BU after sophomore year and moved to New York to start my career. And I went to Circle in the Square because my parents wanted me to have some kind of structure, probably smart. But I dropped out of that after 3 months because I got my equity card doing a tour of children's theater. And so I toured with that for 9 months and got my equity card and felt very much like I was on my way. And I kind of was, I guess. Yes, I guess I was on my way.
Wow.
And just a little side note, this past March, I went back to Boston University and spoke to the students at College of Fine Arts. It was School of Fine Arts when I was there. I spoke to the acting students and I sat down in front of them and I said, "I sat in this room 50 years ago." Couldn't believe it. I could say that, but it's true. It's 50 years since I was in college.
Did you tell them that you dropped out?
Yes, I did. And when the dean and I spoke, when this all sort of came about, I said, "You know, I dropped out of BU." He said, "Yeah, I know, but we're claiming you anyway."
So did you recommend for any of the kids to drop out, or you said stay with?
No, I think it's totally up to, you know, if you're learning stuff and you feel happy where you are, then why not stay? Boston University is a great school now. They teach them how to do their taxes and do self-tapes and things. So if I had gone to that Boston University, I probably would have finished.
If they had taught you how to do your taxes, you would have stayed.
You do your taxes, for God's sake.
So you get your equity card and you're in New York.
Yes.
So at that point, you feel like you know what you're doing. You're like, "I'm a professional actor," or?
I feel like I'm a professional actor, but I was very ambitious and very impatient. And so, you know, I was hopped up, ready to go. the best thing that ever happened to me in my early days in New York is I got into an acting class that was sponsored by the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. They were the people that put on the Emmy Awards. I guess they still do. They call themselves something else. And this acting class was free, which was unbelievable. And I was in that class for probably about 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And we had two teachers in that time. One was a man named Tad Danielewski, who had been a Polish resistance fighter in World War II. And he was quite brilliant and very approached the work very technically. You know, the three legs of the triangle, that the things I talked to you about, the loud exercise and the whisper and those things, those were all from him. And then he left us and went to Brigham Young University, got out of the city. And he was replaced by a man named Gene Lasko, who I really studied with longer than Tad. And he was from the Actors Studio. And so he approached it he wasn't slavish to the studio and the method, but he was much more that than Tad. So the combination of Tad's technical approach and Gene's emotional approach was perfect for me. And really, I give that class credit for pretty much everything I know as an actor.
And it was a free class.
It was a free class. I don't know how that happened. I don't know. I don't understand it even now. But it was a free class. And we met, I think we met twice a week for a long time. It was fantastic. Sigourney Weaver was in the class and Mercedes Rule was in the class. And they were new to New York. Sigourney had just moved to New York. And it was a profound, profound time in my life. The friendships that I made there and the work that I did there and things that I learned. So that I really give a shout out to those two men.
And had you already, your New York debut was in 1976 at Playwrights Horizons. Is that correct?
That's right. This workshop put on a showcase called The Watchdog's Revenge in 1976. And Sigourney was in it, and I was in it. And a couple of Sigourney's friends from Yale, Albert Innerato and Peter Mark Shifter, came to see it. And Sigourney was going to do a play of theirs right after The Watchdog's Revenge. And they saw me in the play and they asked me if I would play Sigourney's little brother in this play called Gemini that was going to have six performances at Playwrights Horizons. And I said, sure. I don't think we got paid. I can't remember, but it was only the second play at the old Playwrights Horizons space. I think there had been one more before that. And we did the six performances. And at the very last performance, a man from Huntington, Long Island at the Performing Arts Foundation, Jay Broad, came to see us because he had lost a play for his theater in Huntington. And he picked us up to go out to Huntington. Sigourney left to do something else. This was pre-Alien. And we all went out. We got a couple of new cast members and we did this play out on Long Island. It was a huge hit. And the very last performance of that production at Huntington, Marshall Mason and Lanford Wilson came because they had lost a play at Circle Rep. And so they picked us up and brought us into New York, where we were the talk of the town. And from there, we moved to Broadway. This was a very early transfer. Things did not move from off-Broadway to Broadway very regularly at that point. Now it happens all the time. And so we moved to Broadway and the play ran 4 years.
That's amazing. It's the fourth longest running Broadway play still to this day.
Still. Yeah.
So how old are you at this point?
I was 22.
Oh my gosh. So you're a baby and you're doing so well.
But I did the play for 2 years. I did it too long. The play was about Sigourney and me surprising her boyfriend from Harvard and my best friend from Harvard, Francis, at his South Philadelphia row house for his 21st birthday. And he's not expecting us to be there to show up. And he's not very happy to see us. The family's not very wealthy and he's embarrassed by where he lives. And he also reveals to Judith, Sigourney's character, Carol Potter, later on Broadway, that he thinks he's not in love with her. He thinks he's in love with my character, who is completely oblivious to it all. And hijinks ensue. So that was the thrust of the play. But my leading characteristic was that I was ordinary. I was just this dumb kid. And everybody else in the play was very flashy and colorful and eccentric. And they all were getting OBs and offers to do other things. And I couldn't get it. I literally could not get another job. So I ended up being in the play for 2 years and way too long. And nobody was minding the play. So it got very out of shape. None of us had done a long run before and didn't really know how to maintain a performance. And so it got pretty wonky. There were some serious egos at play. And so it weirdly became quite a painful experience to be in. Yeah, if you'd said to me on opening night of Gemini, this was going to end up being a really painful job, I would have said, how is that possible? I'm 22 and I'm on Broadway. Leave me alone. But it goes to the point that show business is both highs and lows, as we all know. And things that are, you know, we hear stories all the time about people who get TV series and then by season four, they're losing their minds and want to quit. So I think one of the ironies is the thing that we hate the most about our job is the job insecurity, but actually needing to find jobs over and over again is actually something that keeps us in very good shape.
Mm. So when you leave the show, what happens?
Well, I left the show because I had finally gotten cast in another play, an adaptation of The Master and Margarita at the Public Theater. I had a huge part. F. Murray Abraham was the master and I was his apprentice. This was before Amadeus. And Andre Servan was directing and he had just had a huge hit with The Cherry Orchard at Lincoln Center. And I thought, oh, well, I've got this Russian drama I'm in and I'm going to be amazing. And this is going to be just what I need after playing Dopey Randy in Gemini for so long. And it was hard, too, because Andre, I thought was going to take me someplace as an actor that I'd never been before. But in fact, he had a very technical, I don't think he knows much about actors or how we work. And every instinct I had was the opposite of his.
Mm.
One performance, he pulled me aside at 5 minutes to places. And he said, in 10 years, you'll be a very great actor. You're so real. You're not an actor now.
Wow.
Places. He may have been right, but that wasn't a very nice thing to do to somebody 5 minutes before they had to go out and do a very difficult role.
Oh, God.
Yeah. But that was a great group of people. And even as hard as it was, it was a huge experience in my life to get to play that part. And you know, you learn more from the failures than you do from the successes, I think. This is not a new idea, but it's true.
When I was looking back through your work, I was like, wow, Reed's done, you have like 100 plus TV film credits. And then you've also, anytime I open a new play and looked at the original cast, I'm like, oh, Reed's in the original cast. You know what I mean? You have like a very enviable career.
Turns out I kind of do. It took a really, really long time before I could understand that it was anything to be admired. There were many years of despair that I'm sort of the poster boy for perseverance. I went twice without working for a full year. And one of those years, I went the full year with no auditions, not a single one. And I was at ICM.
Oh, wow. What, around when was this?
This was in 1982.
Okay.
I had a movie with Arthur Penn called Four Friends, my movie debut. And it was a wonderful script by Steve Tesich and Arthur Penn, of course, who did The Miracle Worker and Bonnie and Clyde. And I had a great part. And when it opened, every agent in America called me up to work with me. And I had just signed with ICM. And they said, oh, well, you know, we can't compete with ICM. Good luck. And then the movie failed. The movie was not a success. Had it been, I might have been in a different position, but it didn't do what we all wanted it to do. And when it wasn't a success and offers weren't coming in, ICM at that point was not a place that was going to beat the bushes for me. So I just languished and sat there. And any momentum I might have had from this performance, by the time I sort of woke up a year later and said, oh, dear, I think I shouldn't be at ICM. I called a lot of these agents back and they said, we're really sorry, but the moment has passed. That was hard.
So then what do you do? What do you do when you hear that?
Well, it just goes in the big regret box, doesn't it? I mean, it's just like, yeah, wow, that was really stupid of me. Before the movie opened, I contacted ICM, and Arthur Penn's agent was Sam Cohn, and Steve Tesich's agent was Sam. And I sort of pushed myself on Sam before the movie opened. If I had been smart, I would have waited for the movie to open and then seen who had reached out to me and then taken meetings. But I jumped the gun, which was foolish. So live and learn.
Because you talk sometimes about having tried to leave the business like three times.
Yeah, I tried three times. I tried three times to quit show business. Like Brokeback Mountain, I sure wish I could quit you.
What do you do when you quit?
Well, the biggest time was 1986, and I was really, really struggling with show business. I really felt like it was killing me. The disappointment of Four Friends was now 5 years out. One of the things that's curious about when you're in a flop play, the play closes and you know it's a flop, and then you deal or grieve or do whatever you do. But with a movie, it's sort of out in the ether. And so you have this thing where you think, well, maybe someone will see it today. It's already been a year since I made it. It came out 4 months ago. Yeah, it didn't get very good reviews, but maybe someone will see it today. And then, you know, so you keep sort of hoping, and there's no closure with a flop movie like that. So after about 5 years, the disappointment of the failure of Four Friends overtook me, and I really felt like the business was killing me. I felt myself shrinking, and I couldn't be around people for 2 seconds without starting a rant about how awful show business was. And so walking up Broadway in May of 85, after a bad audition, a little voice literally said in my ear, like I'm talking to you, take a trip around the world. And my grandmother had died and left me some money. And I went home to the woman I was living with at the time. I said, if nothing happens for me in 6 months, I'm going to leave and travel around the world. Incredible thing to say. Incredible thing to hear. So I spent that 6 months really trying to make something happen. I remember a week before I was meant to go, I called my agent in a panic and I said, isn't there anything to keep me here? You gotta find me something. I can't go away. He said, you gotta go on this trip, Reed. You gotta go. So in December of 85, I moved to Paris and was in Paris for 5 months, and then took off with a backpack and went to Greece and bummed around Greek islands for a while. And I went to Africa and Zimbabwe and Kenya, and then Bali and Australia. It was one of my proudest accomplishments, truly, and changed me in a deep way. I came back raring to go. You know, I realized at some point on the trip that I was an actor, and I came back and I got a job pretty quickly, but things didn't really change. I just was sort of skating along, not really making any progress. It didn't feel like. So by 94, I was back at it again. I went to a career counselor, a headhunter, who had successfully rehabilitated several of my actor friends, found them lovely new careers. And I went to her for 3 months. And at the end, she said, I got bad news, Reed. You're an actor.
Wow. Did she make you try other jobs, or was it?
No,
just
it was a lot of like list making and, you know, what do you see? Could you see yourself this? And it was very thorough and very smart. And as I say, it worked for several friends, but didn't work for me. But I think she was right. I think I am an actor, for better or for worse.
Mm. You know? Did you feel like during those years, were you questioning your own abilities, or were you more angry at the business for not seeing you?
It's more that.
Okay. So you never doubted yourself?
No, I never did. And that was part of the rage, was that I thought, geez, I think I'm pretty good, but nobody's buying what I'm selling. Nobody's interested. And you start to feel like you're out of your mind. And it started to feel like if I had been in a relationship that was treating me as badly as show business was treating me, anybody would have said, you've got to get out of that relationship. That relationship is bad for you. It was bad for me. I hadn't figured out a way to be an actor and deal with the despair and the rejection. And, you know, we all do. Look, I think for movie stars, it's bad. There's always a new guy and there's always a younger guy. And you're in two flop movies and then nobody wants you. So, you know, it's a cruel, cruel mistress.
And so what were you doing to keep on?
I was, you know, carrying on. I was auditioning and I was getting plays and I would get the ubiquitous Law and Order from time to time. If you look at my IMDb page, there's a big break in film work from, I think, 1984 to 1991. I did one movie. I was in this very bad movie called A Perfect Murder with Michael Douglas and Gwyneth Paltrow. And I was cast as one of Michael Douglas's poker playing buddies. I didn't know how to play poker. I showed up there and Michael comes in and says, let's really play, everybody. Let's just really play and they'll film us. And I was like, oh my God, my biggest nightmare. I don't know anything about poker. And, you know, they dealt the cards around and everybody picked up their hands and I didn't know what to do. And, you know, there was a nice laugh at the table. You don't know how to play poker? No, I don't. I'm sorry to say, and I'm okay with that, but I'm sorry I'm letting all of you down. And I think in the final movie, I think only the back of my head is in the thing. That was a dark time. Dark, dark time. Couldn't get anything. Having played big parts in a couple of movies, I was suddenly, you know, basically an extra.
That's so hard. Yeah. And your whole family is in showbiz.
Now, yeah, Connie, my wife, Connie Schulman, is a fantastic actress. We met doing a play. And now our son, Ephraim, who's 26, he's in a play at Hartford Theater Works right now and nominated for an Outer Critics Circle Award for the play we did together last fall, Chester Bailey. And our daughter, Gus, is in the sign in Sidney Brustein's Window on Broadway right now. So they're both doing really well. I have no doubt it's only a matter of minutes before I'm primarily known as their father.
It's so exciting. How did you feel when they turned to you and said, we want to be actors?
Well, I mean, you know what it was like when you would say you wanted to be an actor and people would try and discourage you, you know, if you can do anything else, do it, all that stuff. It wasn't my business to discourage them. Mm-hmm. If that's what they want to do, then that's what they want to do. If that's their bliss, I'm very, very happy that they're both very, very good. So there isn't there's the pain and despair when you see their feelings get hurt and they don't get things that they want, but you know, it's not because they aren't any good.
Mm. Do they ask you for notes or do you offer notes sometimes?
Connie usually works on their self-tapes with them.
Oh, really?
But I find, when I have a self-tape and stuff, I find acting in front of my family deeply, deeply embarrassing. So I will do anything rather than put myself on tape with them helping me. I can help them just fine. I don't like acting in front of them. It's silly.
Do you get self-conscious?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do. I don't like, you know, making faces. I'm a grown-ass man. What am I doing jumping around? Pretending to be somebody else.
And so as you were coming up, did you like auditioning? Was it something you felt good at or was it hard for you?
I wouldn't say I liked it. I wouldn't say I hated it. I don't like it now. I find it traumatizing now.
More so than before.
Yeah, more so than before. I don't think I ever was somebody who got parts from auditions. I really don't think, if I look back, there are a handful that I got, but just the walking in and reading it once and reading it twice, that's not ever been how I've gotten jobs. If I've had work sessions, I can get a job, that kind of thing. Or if I start doing a reading of a play and sort of get in on the ground floor that way, I've gotten several plays that way. But I don't seem to be somebody that goes in and knocks them out of their chairs in the room. Yeah. You know, it's a necessary evil. I know one actress who hates it so much that she sort of uses it to walk into the room and just let her rage propel her. And she had a pretty good career for a time. And then she didn't. And I don't know whether the rage took over or what happened. You know, it's just harder for women, I think, as you get older anyway.
Do you feel like things got easier for you as you got older?
No, I don't feel that way. I did a play in 2007 where I had seven lines, and it was at Manhattan Theater Club, and I didn't want to do it. I didn't like the part, but I did it because I thought it would be a good career move to do a play at Manhattan Theater Club. And, it was not a success. And I thought to myself when it was over, all right, look, the dream did not come true. I did not become a movie star. I did not become a star. So going forward, there's not that much time left. I think I was 53 or four. It just has to be about whether I want to play the part now. And if I want to play a part that's in St. Louis, then that's what I do. I can't do things because I think they're going to be good career moves. I have to do, it has to be, if I'm lucky enough to get a part, it has to be a part that I want to play. And the very next job I had was Blasted at Soho Rep, which is the job that changed my career. And I don't know, maybe is it a coincidence that once I had made up my mind about that, about how I was going to move forward, that the next job was the thing that did it for me. Blasted was at a 75-seat theater, Soho Rep. I think we got $275 a week. But it was an incredible part that scared the hell out of me. And that's why I did it. I thought, if it's this scary, I got to do it. And that's what changed things. And things got easier after that, in that a whole group of people that didn't know me before, Annie Baker and Sam Gold and the younger people who wouldn't have had any idea who I was, learned about me in that. And from that came Circle Mirror Transformation and Uncle Vanya and, you know, these really beautiful jobs that I had that were, you know, if you'd said to me at 22 when I was in Gemini, just wait till you're in your 50s, things will be great, I would have killed myself. Because I was a cutie pie, and I thought, you know, I have to strike while I'm cute. And it never occurred to me that there were great parts as an older person. And none of my dream roles were old people. In fact, I remember being in college and somebody was talking about Uncle Vanya, and I looked at it and I read it and said, there's nothing for me in here.
That's funny.
That was one of the best jobs I ever had.
And how did you get Blasted? Was that an offer? Did you audition for that?
Marin Ireland had worked with Sarah Kane's brother, Sarah Kane, the playwright. Mm-hmm. So he knew her. Sarah had already died. She killed herself. She wrote five plays and killed herself. Anyhow, Marin called up Simon Kane and said, I think we should do Blasted in New York. And he said, well, I came over a year ago to try and find a theater to do Blasted, and nobody would do it. They were all too scared of it. She said, well, Soho Rep wants to do it. And he said, if you play Kate, then I'll give you the rights. And Sarah Benson, who directed it, then said to Marin, who would you feel safe playing with Ian? And she said, Reed. So I owe Marin an enormous, enormous debt. I read the script and it literally made me sick to my stomach. I thought, there's no way I could do this. And then I thought, well, Soho Rep's not asking me to do this reading of Blasted as a favor. They're asking me because it's a big deal for them. And they seem to think I could be good in this part. If they think I could be good in it, who am I to think I couldn't be? So we did a reading of it that was probably terrible, but it was good enough that Sarah Benson committed to Marin, Louis Cancelmi, and me to do the play. And I had to, on page three of Blasted, I take off all my clothes and say to Marin's character, put your mouth on me. So that's page three. And I promise you, it wasn't meant to be sexy. It was meant to be disgusting. And so my actor vanity was like, am I really ready to take off all my clothes and have the audience recoil? So the third day of rehearsal, I took off all my clothes because I thought, I don't want this thing hanging over my head. And there was a lot of timing around the getting off and getting dressed and getting. So I did it and I didn't die. And I thought, oh, okay, let's go. Let's do this thing. And it was incredibly empowering and liberating. And I came to realize that this dark, awful character was maybe the part I was living my life to play. I had always played these sort of nice, good, waspy, gurney characters. And if I'd gone to see Blasted, I would never have been sitting in the audience and saying, why wasn't I seen for that?
Mm.
But turns out that was the part I'd been waiting for my whole life.
The darkness.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And then just flashing forward a little bit, so you end up going back to MTC and you work there. So maybe that 7-line role was...
Well, weirdly, very, very first job I literally had in New York in 1976 was at Manhattan Theater Club when they were at the Polish Community Center on 73rd and 2nd. And I was hired to move furniture, but they gave me, because I was equity, they gave me 2 lines. It was a play called The Sun, and it was very, very bad. But that was literally my very first job. And Lynn Meadow and Barry Grove were running it then. And so Lynn and I have known each other since 1976. But I would not say that the Manhattan Theater Club was ever a place that I mean, between 1976 and 2007, I never worked at Manhattan Theater Club. They weren't that interested in me. But I had a wonderful time in Casa Valentina, the Harvey Fierstein play in 2014.
And that was your first Tony nom.
That was my first Tony nomination. It was indeed.
How did that feel?
Pretty good.
Was it like it's about time?
A little bit. It was a little bit like that. Yeah. That was a wonderful, wonderful job. A great group of people. Fantastic part. And I was very, very grateful to have it. And it was, again, it was exploring some dark stuff. It was Charlotte, the character I was playing, was pretty, really a villainess, but I loved it. And I got to work with Joe Mantello for the first time. And I'd known him sort of around the campus for a while before he was a director. And so he's a fantastic director. And so that was, yeah. And then I was nominated 2 years later for The Humans. And it was interesting that Mark Rylance won the first year, and the word had been sort of on the street that he was going to win. The second year, the Humans year, the word on the street was that I was going to win. And it's a 6-week period between the nomination and the awards. And I woke up one day in the middle of all that time and I thought, oh God, I think it's probably a really good thing that I didn't get famous when I was in my 20s after Four Friends, because this is a lot of noise. It's a lot of blather and a lot of who's going to win, who's not going to win, who should win, blah, 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 blah. And I could barely handle it. And I was supposed to win. So I thought, you know what? I'm probably, my career and maybe my life has unfolded exactly as it was meant to.
Who is making the noise?
Oh, you know, press stuff, that you do all this press.
Mm.
You're dragged around to these interviews and people will come up to you and say, you know, you're going to win or you're not going to win. How does it feel to be, competing against Mark Rylance? And I was like, oh, what do you want me to say? It feels fantastic.
Mm.
There was one thing online that I stupidly read that was like, nobody had been talking about me winning. And one sad little boy said, I think Reed Birney should win. And the next thing was like, he's not going to win. That's not going to win.
Oh.
Yeah. Just deal with what you can.
Wow. That's incredible. So before Blasted, those years, did you ever worry about making a living or raising your family as an actor?
Well, of course I did. Of course I did. I mean, it's always a struggle. I worry about it still. You know, living in New York and a family of four, it's expensive. I had a little bit of a cushion, but not much. And there were times that I really had to call home and ask for money. And I was lucky that I didn't have to do a lot of day jobs. There was one time I did a day job at Lincoln Center, where I still have never worked, stuffing tickets into envelopes, which was painful for plays that I feel like, oh, I should have been in that play, not sending tickets out for it. Mm. But I want written on my tombstone, he never worked at Lincoln Center.
What if they offer you a job tomorrow?
Too late. They're not going to.
To wrap this up, I would like to ask if you could tell your younger self at any point, at any of the difficult points, one thing, what would you tell them?
I would say a couple of things. I'd say, don't waste your time being depressed. Don't waste your time in despair. It accomplishes nothing and makes your life bad. It's not worth it. And I would say, now that I'm sort of careening down the other side of the mountain, I would say, it goes really fast and you need to have some fun along the way and enjoy it. And, you know, not everybody's dreams come true. Most people's dreams don't come true. It's all right. I've had a terrific life and I'm very proud of the work I've done, and I'm proud of my family, and I'm proud of the relationships I have. And I have nothing, really, truly nothing to regret, because the regrets, anything that I think I would regret, I have to really, at the end of the day, be grateful for, because they led me to where I am right now.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's really fun to talk to you. Any other questions?
I think that's a good note to end on.
All right.
Keep them hopeful, I think. Keep it optimistic.
Yeah. Look, it's a terrible, terrible business, but it's also a beautiful, beautiful business. It's a beautiful life to get to create and tell stories. And, you know, I think I say to young actors, act wherever you can. If it's in a storefront on the Lower East Side, or if it's a reading in a friend's living room, any chance you can get to act is valuable. And you never know where any of them will lead. That the director of that storefront play in 5 years could be working on Broadway. So just trust you are where you're supposed to be. That's a hard one, but I think it's really true.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay.
That was Reed Burney. Thank you so much for tuning back into Upstage Left. It really means so much to me. I hope you have a great summer. Hopefully I'll put out a few more episodes before the end of the season. Until next time, have a great day.